Well, we continue our series in John's Gospel, so please come with me to John chapter 15, and we're looking at verse 18 to chapter 16 and verse 4. Now, John's Gospel reads like a court case. The claim is made, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And witnesses are called, as John the Baptist, Moses, Christ's words, Christ's works, Christ himself, the Father. And who sits in judgment? Well, apparently it's the world. And as the case proceeds, and as the light shines, so step by step the world reaches its verdict. And it rejects Jesus' claims and puts him to death. But actually it's the other way round. It's not Jesus who is in the dock, but the world. And by rejecting the light, the world condemns itself. A court case. And a court case is very much the feel as we come to these verses. The language at times is forensic, legal. Verse 22, they have no excuse. The world can't plead ignorance. Or verse 25, they hated me without a cause. That's a legal term. It's a quote from Psalm 35. And if you read Psalm 35, it reads like a court case. Or verse 26, but when the helper comes, could be translated, when the advocate comes, one who pleads your case. The Spirit will come to the court to defend Jesus, and he'll do it with the help, verse 27, of witnesses. And you also will bear witness. It's a court case, Jesus versus the world. And in Jewish law, it was different from our law. In our law, we have three parties, don't we? We have the accused, and then we have the defense, and then the prosecution. But in Jewish law, there were just two parties. There was the accused and the accuser. And if the accused was found guilty, then the accuser was declared righteous. But if the accused was found innocent, then the accuser was declared guilty and condemned. Two contending parties. At the end of the case, one will be found guilty and one will be found righteous. It's Jesus versus the world. So if you line up with Jesus, if you're called as a witness to speak for him, then you can expect to be opposed by the world. This is head to head, isn't it? Jesus versus the world. Well, I hope that gives us some sort of feel as we now plunge into the verses. What we're going to do, we'll simply go through the verses, we'll expound them, we'll open them up. What is it saying? And then we'll draw the lessons. So please have John 15, 18 to 16, verse 4, open in front of you. Now, what characterizes the people of God? We've looked at verses 9, 12, 17. One word characterizes the people of God. That's love. So what characterizes the world? Verse 18, one word. Hate. If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. And in fact, if you look at these chapters, chapters 14 and 15, you'll find there's a symmetry. God's attitude towards the disciples reflects his attitude towards Jesus, love. The world's attitude towards the disciples reflects his attitude towards Jesus, hate. The common denominator, Jesus. So to be united to Jesus, to be identified with Jesus, to belong to the Lord, means that you'll be loved by the Father and that you'll be hated by the world. Verse 19, if you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Kid goes to a new school, desperate to belong. So what do? Well, they adopt the language, don't they? They adopt the behavior of their classmates. Sometimes they adopt the way their classmates dress. If they don't, if they're not one of their own, if they don't belong, then the kid's rejected. Christians don't fit in. They no longer belong. They talk differently. They act differently. And I hope at times ladies, they dress differently. And so they're rejected. The world is in rebellion to the rightful king. Now, it's fine if you're a fellow rebel, because you're on the same side. But you change sides. You bow the knee to the king. You take the king's uniform. You obey the king's orders. You remind the rebels that they're rebelling. You remind them by their life of the king that they hate. You then speak of the king himself. And says Jesus, they will hate you. Now look at verse 19. How many times in one verse does Jesus use the word world? You actually need to use it once, don't you? But he uses the word five times. Five times in one verse he says world. Why? He's making a point. He's saying when the world hates you, no surprise, that is what the world that stands in opposition to God, that hates Jesus Christ, that is what the world is like. Verse 20, remember the word that I said to you, the servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. Servants are identified with their masters. So this is Jesus, the way they treat me, the master, is the way they'll treat you, the servants. Did they persecute me? Then they'll persecute you. Did they listen to me? Well, a handful did listen to him. So don't expect the world to listen to you. Oh, some will listen. Because he does say, verse 20, if they kept my word, they will keep yours also. Some will listen. They'll treat me the way that they'll treat you the way they treated me. Have you seen Disney's Aladdin? And the villain Jafar has a parrot. And it's a sort of wise-cracking, cynical, ultra-sarcastic parrot. And when things turn out as they do, the parrot keeps saying, why am I not surprised? I'm going to die of not surprise. So when the world hates you and persecutes you, don't be surprised. Okay, but why do they hate? Well, we said it already. It's because they're in rebellion to the king, and if you go and join the king's side, they'll be against you. But Jesus lets us dig a bit deeper. Verse 21. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. So they persecute Christians because they belong to Jesus. Because, says Jesus, they do not know him who sent me. They don't know the Father. So why do they hate? Well, says Jesus, don't look for a rational explanation. The reason they hate, it's fallen, demonic, human nature in the raw. Because they do not know him who sent me. When Jesus came, he revealed the Father. He who has seen me has seen the Father. So they saw the godness of God in the face of Jesus Christ. They saw grace abounding. They saw love divine. They saw the glory. Jesus made the Father known. But the world didn't want to know. The more they saw what God was like, the more they rejected him. And the more they rejected his Son. And the more, therefore, says Jesus, they will reject you. Let's put it another way. If the world had known the Father, and the word known there is being used in its full biblical sense. You know, we know about all sorts of things, don't we? But we don't really know about them. It's being used in a biblical sense. To know means you have a relationship of love, of trust, of intimacy. Okay? If the world had known, if the world had loved, if the world had obeyed the Father, then it would have welcomed the Son, the revealer of the Father, and it would, of course, welcome his people. All these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. And this ignorance, this not knowing, says Jesus is culpable. Verse 22. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would have no sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. Verse 24. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin. But now they have seen and also hated both me and my Father. Jesus made the Father known. Verse 22. No one spoke like Jesus. Verse 24. No one did the works that Jesus did. But whose words were they? Whose works were they? And the answer throughout John's Gospel is that they were the Father's words that he spoke. They were the Father's works that he did. Now, he's a turn to it, but so for example, John 12, verse 49, for I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak. Jesus doesn't speak his own words. He speaks the words of the Father. And it's the same for his works. Again, you can turn to a number of scriptures. I'll just turn to one. Assuredly, says John 5, verse 19, most assuredly I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself. For what he sees the Father do, for whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner. See what Jesus is saying? We get the idea that Jesus and the Father are two beings. They're not. They're one being, two persons. Jesus is the revealer of the Father. The words that he spoke were the Father's words. The works he did were the Father's works. By looking at Jesus, you saw the Father. So when Jesus came, what happened? They were exposed to the loveliest of all beings. They were exposed to the sublime perfections of deity. They were exposed to the perfect revelation of God himself. Because by looking at Jesus, you see the Father, you see God. And what did they do? They rejected it all. The more they looked at Jesus, the more they listened to him, the more they saw his works, the more they understood what God was like. The more they saw the Father. The Father revealed in the Son. And the more they saw what God was like, the more they hated the Father, they hated the Son. That's why Jesus says, verse 23, he who hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin, but now they have seen. They've seen me, they've seen the Father, and also hated both me and the Father. You see, it's saying the absolute madness of human nature. The more they saw what God was like, the more they hated God. That's what human nature is like. If Christ had never revealed the Father, he'd have been welcomed. It's because they understood this is what God is like. But they hated him and rejected him. You see what Jesus is saying? When therefore they hate and persecute you, don't look for rational explanations. It's not because of this reason or that reason. It's naked hatred of God. And therefore, verse 22, they are without excuse. And therefore, verse 24, they're flying in the face of the evidence. It's because they've seen what God is like and they hate it. And in passing their verdict on the Father and on the Son and on his people, what are they doing? They're simply underlining the madness of their sin. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin, but now they have seen and also hated both me and my Father. Don't be surprised when the world hates you. Not for any rational reason, not for anything that makes sense. How could you hate Jesus Christ? It's because they saw the Father. They hate the Father, therefore they hate the Son. And therefore when they meet Christians, they hate Christians, inasmuch as they see God in them. And then Jesus sums it all up by quoting Psalm 35, verse 25. But this happened that the word might be fulfilled, which was written in their law, they hated me without a cause. You know, when David was accused, when David was rejected, it wasn't true. The things they said about him weren't true. There was nothing in it. Well, the pattern's been trailed in David. And that pattern is now fulfilled in David's son. They hated me without a cause. Don't be surprised, Christian friends, when they hate you. That same pattern will be fulfilled in you because you're identified with Jesus. I've mentioned several times from this place the martyrdom of Blandina, a second century slave girl. And she was tortured until her tormentors ran out of ideas. And an eyewitness wrote, they were amazed she was still breathing. For her whole body was mangled and her wounds gaped. They declared that torment of any one kind was enough to part body and soul, let alone a succession of torments of such extreme severity. But the blessed woman wrestled magnificently, grew in strength as she proclaimed her faith, and found refreshment, rest, and indifference to her sufferings in uttering the words, I am a Christian. We do nothing to be ashamed of. They hated me without a cause. You can think of the Bible believers, Peter and Hazel Mary Bull. They've been convicted in order to pay compensation for refusing to give a double room in their guest house to a homosexual couple. It's been the rule in their guest house for 25 years that if you want a double bed, you have to be married. So whether you're heterosexual or homosexual, if you're not married, you can't have a double bed in their guest house. Another on the receiving end of a hate campaign. Now, they're pensioners. When the verdict came through, he was in hospital having heart surgery. And one of the milder emails they received says this. You disgust me, and all decent folk, you foul, foul beings. I hope you go bankrupt as a result of this. You are both vile specimens of humanity, and you will go to hell. And what did she say? She said, but we are Christians, and we have nothing to be ashamed of. They hated me without a cause. Look at verse 26. But when the Helper comes, whom I shall send to you from the Father, the Spirit of truth who proceeds from the Father, he will testify of me. At verse 26, we turn a corner. So far in this court case, Jesus has been accused and condemned, and soon he will be executed. But that's not the end of the trial. That's only phase one. The hearing will go on. Another will come to the court. He's the helper. He's the advocate. He deals in the truth. He's the Spirit of truth. He's my other self, says Jesus, whom I will send from the Father, and he will testify of me. He'll put the record straight. And verse 27, you, the disciples, will also be called to give evidence, to bear witness, to give your testimony, because you have been with me from the beginning. You know the facts. You're my disciples, and therefore the truth must be told. And Christian friends, we too are called to testify. The Spirit will call us to the witness box to testify of Jesus. And we do so with the help and empowering of the Spirit. We do so with open Bibles because they are the eyewitness accounts. And we do so with our own testimony. We too are called to give evidence in this trial of Jesus versus the world. You can't get through this life Christian friend, without taking the witness stand, without being identified with Jesus. And now Jesus pulled it all together. Don't be surprised by the world's hatred and hostility. Don't be surprised when it defies reason. It's because you're identified with me, all these things they would do to you for my name's sake. So chapter 16, verse 1, these things I have spoken to you that you should not be made to stumble. So Jesus says, I'm telling you now so that come crunch time, you don't abandon me. When I'm gone, the world's hatred will be now directed towards you. So don't stumble. There's a greater danger than being persecuted. And that's walking out on me. So what can you expect? Verse 2. They will put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God service. You'll be put out of the synagogue, the center of Jewish life. You'll be cut off from your communities. Indeed, in the name of God, they will take your very life from you. In the days of Mary Tudor in this country, when hundreds of believers were burnt at the stake. And there they were, chained to the stake, waiting for the fire. And as they waited, what did they have to do? They had to listen to a sermon being preached to them. A priest got up and preached a message to them because they were heretics. And they were being burnt at the stake in the name of God. The time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God service. And then again the reminder, verse 3, these things they will do to you because they have not known the Father nor me. The world had known and loved the Father, then the world would have known and loved the Son, and therefore the world would know and love and embrace the people of God. Because the world doesn't know the Father, it doesn't know the Son, and therefore it will reject his people. So again, no surprise when these things happen to you. Verse 4. But these things I have told you, that when the time comes, you may remember that I told you of them, and these things I did not say to you at the beginning, because I was with you. He's saying no surprises then. When crunch time comes, no apostasy. Don't walk out on me. I'm telling you now, says Jesus, because so far the focus has been on me. The world's been after me. And I've been able to protect you. But when I'm gone, they'll turn their hatred towards you. Well, that's the exposition. Let's close with four lessons. And the first lesson is, we've been saying all the way through, don't be surprised. The history of the church can be written in the blood of God's people. The persecution of Christians is a fact of the ages. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Every child of God, called to Jesus' side, born again, chosen by him, chosen out of this world, they will find themselves persecuted. Chapter 16, verse 1. These things I have spoken to you that you should not be made to stumble. So that when crunch time comes, you're not taken unawares. You're not taken by surprise. Don't be surprised. So Paul says, yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. The Apostle Peter, he says, put in a very interesting way. He says, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. Here are people who are going to be persecuted. Well, don't think anything's gone wrong. Don't think it's strange what's happening. This shouldn't be going on. We're Christians. Isn't God looking after us? On the contrary, he says, rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of Christ rests upon you. On their part he has blasphemed, but on your part he is glorified. And then John, what does he say in Revelation? They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. So, Christian friend, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised when you're excluded. They will put you out of the synagogues. As we said, it's the center of the Jewish world. If you put out of the synagogue, you lose contact with your family. You lose contact with your friends. You lose contact with your community. You lose contact with your roots. You're cut off. You're put out. Don't be surprised if you're excluded. In the ancient world, many of the occupations were tied to a trade guild. And when they had their trade guild meetings, they would offer incense worship to their idol. Every trade guild had its own god. So you couldn't be a Christian and belong to the trade guild, because if you belong to a trade guild, it involved you taking part in idolatry. So for many of those early Christians, to become a Christian meant to lose your job. You lost your livelihood. You lost everything you'd worked for. But she says, they'll go so much further, won't they? The time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God's service. For 2 centuries, the official policy in the Roman Empire was to execute believers. They were given a test which everyone else could pass. Say Caesar is Lord. Little pinch of incense, go to the altar, drop the incense on the altar. Just say Caesar is Lord. Acknowledge that Caesar is divine. And what did the Christians reply? Jesus is Lord. And they were put to death. And the Roman Empire, whenever disaster struck, some river flooded, there was some local problem, some difficulty or trouble, the cry would go up, Christians to the lions. Time to appease the gods. And we'll appease them with the blood of Christians. Where do you think the saints' days came from? You know, all these different saints, there's a different day for different saints. Now, I know it's all got twisted and perverted and all the other things. But where did it originally come from? It was because in the early church there were so many of God's people who were put to death, and put to death in such heroic circumstances, that the early church wanted to remember them. We can't forget them. We can't forget the heroic stand they made, the words that they spoke. So on this particular day, we'll remember this brother. We'll remember this sister for what they've done. And the persecution continues, doesn't it? If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. I'm listening to a brother who was returning to Pakistan to preach the gospel. And his first convert was murdered by her family. And he was convicted for the crime and put into prison. Or the Iranian pastors who were found hanging on meat hooks. Or our brothers and sisters in Sri Lanka, who are threatened and beaten and denied the use of communal wells and denied the medical help which they need. And we could go through, couldn't we, the persecution in North Korea. It used to be called the Jerusalem of the East, the capital of North Korea. I can't remember what it is now. But there were large, huge numbers of Christians in North Korea. And there's still many Christians there, persecuted. Or Somalia, or China, or Eritrea, Iraq, Sudan. Imagine taking lads and tying their hands and feet behind their back and holding them over burning coals and ordering them to deny Jesus. And these young Sudanese lads, they didn't. They refused to deny Jesus. And many of them died. They didn't love their lives to the death. Some have estimated, and it's almost impossible to make these estimations in one sense, isn't it? Because we don't know all the facts and figures. But some have estimated that more believers have been martyred in the 20th century than any previous century. In fact, some have gone so far to say more believers have been martyred in the 20th century than all the previous centuries put together. So no surprise, you know, we have a very Western view of the world, don't we? 6 billion people on the planet, what, just 200 or 300 million people in Europe. We think Europe is the world, don't we? It's a tiny, tiny part of the world. All the people of God persecuted across the world. We have a very small view of the world, don't we? But don't be surprised if the temperature's turned up here. And no surprise if the opposition is irrational and hateful and blind. They hated me without a cause. Are they in 21st century Britain finding a test which everyone else can pass except the people of God? There's more than one way of saying Caesar is Lord, isn't there? And don't forget this. This is the country that has soaked up the blood of many of God's people. From the attacks of the pagan Druids and Saxons and Vikings, slaughtering the people of God, or the martyrs during the reign of Mary, or the Covenanters, or the attacks on the nonconformists. Why are they called nonconformists? Why are we a nonconformist church? Because they wouldn't conform. They were a dissenting people. Think of John Bunyan. 12 years in Bedford jail. For what? What was his crime? He preached the gospel. The magistrate said, "You're not to preach the gospel." He said, "I can't. Christ has told me I've got to preach." They said to him, "Well, don't you love your wife and your children?" He said, "Indeed, I do very dearly. But in comparison with Jesus Christ, I do not love them at all." And so for 12 years he was imprisoned. It was done in the name of God. Don't be surprised. So the second lesson is, moving on more quickly, how identified with Jesus am I? Look at verse 27. "And you will also bear witness, because you've been with me." In the Roman Empire, there was another group who refused to say Caesar is Lord. So who was that? They were the Jews. But the Romans left them alone. Why? Because the Jews didn't go around converting people. But they couldn't shut the Christians up. They bore witness to Jesus Christ. He was their boast. That's why they're regarded as troublemakers. That's why they were called haters of humanity. Because you couldn't stop them. They kept, wherever they went, they told people about the Christ. Well, how much trouble do we make? It's been said the triumph of a dictatorship is when its citizens censor themselves. Do I censor myself? Am I a spiritual chameleon? I'm very good at blending with the background, so I'm unseen. Am I afraid of losing my reputation? Am I afraid of being unpopular? Am I viewed as just a good moral churchgoer or a passionate lover of Jesus Christ? You also will bear witness. Does the Spirit of God call me to the witness box? Does he call me into situations so I may speak for Jesus, so I may live for Jesus? Why am I where I am? In my family, in my street, in my job, in my pastimes. Why has he put me there? It's to call me to the witness box, to testify of Jesus Christ. Christian friend, what is my heartbeat? Especially in this country. I mean, it costs us nothing, does it, to stand up for Jesus? You know, the worst I'll get is someone will frown at me or say something a bit nasty to me. Well, it doesn't cost us anything, does it? Really? No one's holding me over burning coals. Am I just a Jew? An ancient traditional religion which the Romans can leave alone. I'm not causing trouble to anyone. Or am I a devoted lover of Jesus Christ? And therefore I'm seen as a troublemaker. I've always been stuck by this poster. I'm sure you've seen it too. I've always found it deeply convicting. The poster says this: "If it was illegal to be a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you?" And the third thing to say is this: persecution puts everything into perspective. If I was persecuted, what then would I think of my Bible? I would be found in situations where my very life depended upon whether I believe the promises of God. The whole of my weight, the whole of my family, everything would be resting upon the promises of God. In situations of persecution, how would I view my Bible? And if the world threatened me, how would I view prayer? How would I view the prayer meeting? You know the situation in Acts 4. I need to turn to it. I'm just going to quickly skim to it. But you know the situation. They're threatened, aren't they? Peter and John threatened. And being let go, they went to their own companions and reported all the chief priests and elders said to them. So when they had heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, and they had this incredible prayer meeting. What then would I think of prayer? A meeting to pray. And if I was hated by everyone, what then would I think of God's people? And if they excluded me, and worse, they'll put you out of the synagogue. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think he offers God service. What then would I think about all the things that I now moan about? Yeah, we go around frowning, we go around moaning, go around complaining. Well, actually, when I put them in the balance, most of the things I moan about are tiny. It's just a pebble in the shoe, isn't it? It irritates me. But I find lots of time and opportunity to moan about it. And if I really didn't know whether, when I went out my front door that day, whether or not they would kill me for Jesus' sake, that today might be my last day upon the earth, today might be the day when Christ calls me into the witness box to testify, and with my last breath, I'm pointing them to Christ. What sort of Christian life would I live then? Knowing this might be my last day. What then would be my consuming passion? What then would I write in Facebook? So, Christian friends, why wait till then? Why wait for persecution? Why am I not living like that now? What would it do to the church? We support Andy and Tatiana Ball. Andy came and spoke a little while ago, and he was telling me about his wife and his wife's father. His wife, Tatiana, she was persecuted under the Soviet regime, and her father was persecuted. And if he was found at a Christian meeting, he was fined a month's wages. So he had a job, but for that month he wouldn't get any wages. And he had a family to feed, had lots of children, wife. Would you keep away from here if it cost you a month's wages? Well, that's a good question, isn't it? Would I keep away from here if it cost me a month's wages? And some of us just opt in and out, don't we, when it suits us. On one occasion, he went 7 months without pay. You see, you couldn't keep him away. He kept meeting with God's people. He had to hear God's word. He had to meet with them to pray. He had to share with them in a hostile, hateful world. Here are my friends. Here are my family. These are my brothers and sisters. I love them. You can't keep me away. And if my boast is Jesus Christ, then the delight of meeting together with his people to worship Christ. Persecution puts everything into perspective, doesn't it? It shows what really matters, which is why Peter says, rejoice. Because the Spirit of glory rests upon you if you're able to stand in that day. But Christian friends, why wait till then? Why am I not living like that now? And the final one. Where does persecution lead? Come with me to Revelation 14. Now, Revelation 14. Persecution is coming to the churches of Asia Minor. The seven churches in Revelation, they're all soon to be persecuted. Persecution's coming. So how do you put heart into people who are soon to face persecution? What do you do? Well, here in chapter 14, they're shown what has become of the believers who are martyred under Nero and closer to Rome. I forget, Adrian Minor's across the sea, it's a distance away from Rome. So they're shown what's happened to the martyrs under Nero and the others. It was a complete number. That's what 144,000 is about. It's a complete number of martyrs. So where are those martyrs? You're talking to people who are soon to lose their lives, soon to be persecuted. What they want to know is what's happened to those who've been martyred before us. Where are they? What's happened to them? So they're told. Chapter 14, "Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. And they sang as it were a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who were not defiled with women, for they are virgins." It just simply means they fought a holy war. In Israel, when they went to war, they kept themselves from women. These people have fought a holy war. "These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb, the first fruits of the martyrs. And in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God." Having fought a holy war, they now sing the victor's song. Having suffered for Jesus Christ, they now reign with him in heaven, never to leave his side. These are the ones who follow the Lamb, it says, wherever he goes. Having in this world taken up their cross, unashamed to own his name. They're therefore with the Lamb on Mount Zion, wearing the crown. So, Christian friends, in the light of that, why am I so reluctant to be identified with the hated Christ? Why should I be afraid to proclaim my allegiance to him? And why ever should I want friendship with the world? Are you willing to take the witness stand and to speak of Jesus with the prospect of glory before us? Let us be unashamed to bear his reproach today.